Did you know that Gateway Seminary offers PhD and THM degrees with accomplished faculty members? And that their PhD program operates on a hybrid model, which is going to combine the best of the American and British systems to ensure students receive a breadth of knowledge through the seminar stage and close one-on-one mentoring during the dissertation writing stage. Gateway is unique in their delivery format, which is going to provide community support and flexible access. Wherever you're located, you have the opportunity to study with the best. If this has piqued your interest, you should go learn more at info.gsdegrees.org/PhD. That's info.gsdegrees.org/PhD. On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. David Rathel about Andrew Fuller and hyper-Calvinism. So we cover all sorts of topics like just what is this hyper-Calvinism? What is the modern question controversy? Why have scholars not paid careful attention to hyper-Calvinism? What sort of problems does this lack of attention end up leading to? Who are these figures that are hyper-Calvinists, especially in the Baptist tradition, and do they all agree on their thought? What sort of alternative theological vision does Fuller set out to cast? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. In doing that, we hope to encourage and cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So we think that you should be both very convictional and very rigorous in your thinking, spotting ideas and examining arguments and being critical in the right sort of fashion. But you should also do it with sort of curiosity and interest in mind, understanding why people think the way they think, and then treating them with the fairness and respect and dignity and honor and those sort of things that anyone made in the image of God deserves. And everybody is made in the image of God. So that, there you go. You have to treat everybody with respect. So we try to do that on the podcast. We talk to all sorts of people, and hopefully that encourages you to think that way, because we talk to people all across the spectrum, all sorts of different traditions, whether that's closer to home and Protestant or other, even further down for me, like a Baptist, or broader than that. We talk to lots of people, and it's a lot of fun to learn. Today, we have our friend Dr. David Rathel on the show. He's been on before, but today we're going to be talking about his forthcoming book with T.N.T. Clark on Andrew Fuller and the search for a faith worthy of all acceptation. So this is designed to explore his soteriology in its historical context. And it's going to be, I think I said T.N.T. Clark. So that means for you nerds out there, if you've got a book budget from your employer, go ahead and pick up a copy. You can pre-order it now on Amazon. But if you don't have that, then go ahead and tell your library that this is a book that is of absolute necessity that must be in the catalogs so that you can get your hands on it and share it with your friends. Now, David, before we jump in, remind us, for those who are newer listeners and don't remember who you are, just a little bit about yourself. And then what was it that really got you interested in thinking about Andrew Fuller?
Sure, Jordan. Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate you. Appreciate the resources that you all put out. Happy to always support you all and your work. I teach now at Gateway Seminary, just outside of Los Angeles, California. I serve as Associate Professor of Christian Theology here. I also direct Gateway's PhD and THM programs. I've been at Gateway for 4 years. But before I came to Gateway, I served as a pastor in the state of Virginia for about 6 years, and then did a PhD overseas at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland for 4 years. And this book came out of the two experiences, the academy over in Scotland, University of St. Andrews, and the church there in Virginia. It has its genesis in my time as a pastor. I was going to school actually at Southeastern Seminary for that season in my life while I was pastoring. And I love the academic conversations at seminary. I love the theological rigor that can come in class. But while I love that, I would leave the Southeastern Seminary or just seminary in general bubble and go up to Virginia where I was pastoring. And there are a whole different set of conversations and an entire different set of questions. And there it was just on the ground, lived reality, Christian experience. People talking about their marriages or people needing counseling over their grandkids. And I love those conversations as well. So basically, I loved being a pastor and loved being with people, and I love theology. And sort of, you used the word nerd a second ago, being a nerd about theology. And so I was trying to find a way to bridge these two worlds together, academy and church. Those conversations are happening a lot now. There are places like the Center for Pastor Theologians. There have been publications about being a pastor theologian. Whenever I was pastoring, those conversations were just starting. They weren't really on the ground running yet. And so I was looking for some sort of model, and I just came across, almost by accident, Andrew Fuller. Someone told me to read Andrew Fuller's writings. So I remember distinctly reading Fuller sitting on my porch one day in our parsonage, in our pastorium where we live next to the church. And I thought, well, whatever it means to be a pastor theologian, this is it. Because he had good, careful, nuanced theology, but he explained it in a really heartfelt, devotional way. It was theology built out of his ministry context and constructed for his ministry context. And so I fell in love with Fuller and some of the people around his life at that time.
That's awesome. Now, before I ask a Fuller-related question, you said Gateway's outside of Los Angeles. Not everybody realizes that. I still think of Gateway as in, like, you're in San Francisco. How long have you guys been in outside of Los Angeles?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So Gateway came down before I moved here. So I'm not going to be the best on the date, but I think it's around 2014, 2015. So Gateway used to be Golden Gate Baptist Theological Seminary. And so if you're of the SBC from a few years back, you'll probably remember references to Golden Gate. We are Golden Gate, just now moved down to Southern California as opposed to the Bay Area, San Francisco.
Awesome. And you're taking care of all the PhD and THM stuff, which is very exciting. Very, very exciting. So now when it comes to Fuller, you mentioned he's this model sort of pastor theologian. I would imagine most non-Baptists have no idea who Fuller is. Even Baptists, a lot of them may not know who Fuller is. And maybe they get him confused with William Carey. You know, it's like somebody somewhere over there doing stuff in the 18th century. Why don't even Baptists know more about who Andrew Fuller is?
No, you're absolutely right. One of the funniest things that's continually happened to me, especially outside of Baptist circles, is whenever I explain my dissertation topic, when I say Fuller, everyone automatically thinks of Fuller Seminary down the road from our institution in Pasadena. And so I have to explain, well, that's a different Fuller that's named after a Fuller from the 20th century. And so you're right, Andrew Fuller is not as well known as we would like. I think it's changing over time, in part because of the Andrew Fuller Center at Southern Seminary, the critical edition of his works that have been coming out slowly over the past few years. I think part of the reason we don't recognize Fuller is sometimes we don't do a good job of telling our own stories and our own history. And I think part of it is sometimes we use history or even theology for polemical ends. And so we just like to cherry pick who in the tradition is most like what we want us to be today. And Fuller doesn't lend himself easily to those sorts of conversations because he is a person marked by charity. He's convictional, but he's gracious. And so he's not someone that will give you a lot of fiery quotes always for the polemics happening today. So those are just two guesses I have. Yeah.
I think you actually reminded me when I was a first year MDiv student at Southern, I had no idea who Andrew Fuller was. And I remember wandering my dorm hall and walking down, and you've got those like old school cork boards. And on that was like one of the flyers for the Andrew Fuller Center. I was like, what is this? Who is that? That was my first exposure. So this book engages significantly a topic that naturally Andrew Fuller was engaging with and dealing with, and that is the topic of high or hyper-Calvinism. So I'd love for you to explain what that is and what that isn't, because I would imagine I've heard a million times hyper-Calvinism just basically mean like anybody who's a Calvinist is a hyper-Calvinist. But there's clearly a technical sense which you're using it in this book in which Fuller is also using it. So help me to understand what that means.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. So as I was reading Fuller, just becoming aware of his work as a pastor theologian, I became convinced that not many people have explored in sufficient detail the context in which he was writing. And he's most famous, as you're saying here, for his soteriology, his conversations around the nature of faith and what it means to have saving faith. And even though we know him for those contributions, we haven't read the people around him, the people he was reading. And so that's really the project here. It's trying to contextualize his theological work in terms of his soteriology. And basically, in Fuller's day, hyper-Calvinism refers to a set of doctrinal beliefs that were uniquely present in the Northamptonshire region in England in the 18th century. And these doctrinal beliefs led to the conclusion and the conviction that someone should not preach the gospel openly in the sense that you openly offer the gospel to all people, like this is a message for you as an individual, and that you also don't compel people to respond to the gospel because you're convinced that not all people have a duty to respond. And there are different forms of this kind of what Fuller called false Calvinism, because it doesn't involve gospel preaching and teaching in an open way and open evangelistic calls. There are different forms of it. I'm addressing in this book this unique form that appeared in Northamptonshire in the 18th century. It really revolved around two different kind of spheres, if you want to call it that, or two different focal points. Some of the people who advocated for this hyper-Calvinism held to eternal justification, and that led them to their belief in a no-gospel offer theology. And other people had an idea about Adam, and they said Adam did not, in the creation event, have an ability to understand the gospel. He had no need to understand the gospel. So there's something intellectually, spiritually, or morally in people that doesn't allow them to believe the gospel without a supernatural work of grace. So based on Adam's pre-fallen inability, people today don't have an ability to believe the gospel. Therefore, they don't have an obligation to believe the gospel. And so a hyper-Calvinist position of Northamptonshire was saying gospel preaching goes out in terms of the indicatives of the gospel. God did this for you. God did this in Christ, rather. But it doesn't have any imperative attached. This is for you, and you must believe.
So, I mean, I've got to imagine that seems very foreign to most people today.
Yeah.
What do you think like really drives people to think that, I mean, I guess there's a sophisticated theological system that you can put together to like get there, but is there anything like other, like that's more pastorally or theologically satisfying that's driving people during this period to embrace this?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I came at this, not because I have a passionate interest in hyper-Calvinism, but because I have interest in Fuller, as we were saying, and then trying to understand Fuller, we have to understand these things. And so these issues matter, not because they're necessarily always relevant today, but because we want to get history right and understand our forefathers correctly. But in terms of this context, this 18th century Northamptonshire scene, what really motivated this was a debate that preceded Fuller or preceded some of his contemporaries. It was a debate around the time of Richard Baxter. And so many people will know Baxter has been associated with a position called neo-nomianism. it's a unique understanding of justification that Baxter has that has some very strong legalistic overtones. So because Baxter was promoting this understanding of justification, there was a response on the part of other people. And one of the most significant responders was a person by the name of Tobias Crisp. And he found the Baxter position to be so legalistic that it was spiritually stifling, that someone could not have assurance of salvation. And so Crisp, long before Fuller, tried to create a theological system that really focused on human passivity before the gospel, that humans don't have to perform a certain action to be in the gospel, to be in Christ. Because he thought, if this is an agency that's taken away from us, we don't have spiritual anxiety over whether we've believed or not or have had sufficient faith or not. So it was a well-intentioned theology he developed that was seeking after an assurance of salvation. And we can get into Crisp in the weeds, but that's basically the core of his message. Okay. So that trajectory stayed in the Northamptonshire region for years, and it continued to harden and become more and more developed. And so over time, this emphasis on human passivity became so strong that you ended up with this hyper-Calvinist position through the influence of people like Joseph Hussey, who took the Crisp system and brought it to its fullness whenever Joseph Hussey said, yes, there's no action you perform. Yes, we're passive before the gospel. Yes, God does all of this work unilaterally in us. And because of that, we don't openly offer the gospel to people. And there's a lot more behind the scenes that kind of gives this some, at least some measure of depth. But in a nutshell, that's the historical trajectory. So Hussey was emphatic that his no-offer gospel position, and Hussey's kind of the key person who turns Crispism into a hyper-Calvinism, Hussey was emphatic that this was about assurance of salvation and spiritual comfort. If you take faith out of someone's hand, so to speak, if you remove human agency, then they can just passively, a person can passively trust God's unilaterally save them.
So how does this relate to the modern question controversy? Is this the same thing? What's the terminology referring to?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Hussey is a Cambridge-based minister who's familiar with the writings of Crisp. Hussey has connections in the Northamptonshire region that are deep, and I think that's how he picks up on the Crisp theology. And as I said, Hussey transforms Crispin theology, Tobias Crisp's message, to this no-offer message. Then through Hussey, this no-offer or hyper-Calvinist message spreads all throughout the Northamptonshire region because it was a ripe season for that no-offer message to be preached. People were already enamored there by the Tobias Crisp theology. So when they hear Joseph Hussey's spin on it, no-offer, they accept that as a logical or at least a sophisticated outworking of the theology they already held with Tobias Crisp. And so people like John Skepp, to a certain extent, Richard Davis, all filter this message out in their context and in their day, John Gill as well. And so this is a form of no offer or hyper-Calvinism that's based on this idea that God justifies the elect before they're born. Salvation is not in their hands. They just passively receive the message of salvation. So that is a form of hyper-Calvinism. Now, as this begins to filter through the Northamptonshire region, eventually some people start to push back. And that's when we have what's called the modern question controversy. And it's named after a publication that emerged in 1737 called The Modern Question Modestly Answered by a Rothwell minister named Matthias Maurice. And so for him, the modern question, the central issue is, will we preach the gospel to all people, telling them that the message is for them and that they have a duty to respond? And so this is how he frames it. This is the modern issue before us. And because he used that phrase in his publication, the modern question answered, modestly answered, the entire controversy now receives the name, Modern Question Debate. And so from the Maurice pamphlet, there are a number of works where people are taking different sides. Someone is arguing for hyper-Calvinism. Someone else is arguing for the position taken by Matthias Maurice, which is we have an offer message now. And so then this really begins to pick up steam in terms of a polemical issue.
Very helpful. I want making me think, what would our modern question be? But that's for another time. So you argue in part of your book about how scholars have not paid careful enough attention to high and hyper-Calvinism. And what sort of problems do you think this lack of attention ends up leading to when it comes to understanding this period?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think some of the reasons we haven't, at first just to say that, is that number one, to given attention to these issues is to really get into a lot of detail with some very eccentric theologians. Some of the most famous people in their day and age in Northamptonshire who were promoting hyper-Calvinism are largely forgotten today. And so you're dealing with kind of eccentric characters on the fringes of some theological conversations. And so I think some people haven't studied this issue because of just the nature of some, not all, but some of the people involved. I think also, honestly, some of these texts are extremely hard to access. And so years ago, I took a PhD seminar on Andrew Fuller, and I remember having to read Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation, which is Fuller's, piece against false or hyper-Calvinism. And I have to be honest, Jordan, I remember, even as a PhD student, just being confused over what Fuller was talking about. And people would tell me in Baptist history class, well, if you want a message about gospel presentation and gospel preaching, read Fuller. And I couldn't find why Fuller would make some of the moves he made in his text. If I was going to talk about gospel preaching, I would have said some different things than Fuller did. And so I just remember being confused. And I think that's because the text that Fuller is responding to, like I said, are from these eccentric characters. And again, they're hard to access. So I'll give you some examples. When I was in the UK doing my PhD, I found that Joseph Hussey's writings, in which he argues for hyper-Calvinism, have been changed in some of the later editions so that his statements about hyper-Calvinism have been removed, or at least his statements have been, taken down a notch in their harshness. And so sometimes in America, we're actually not reading the original edition, and we're not seeing what was really happening on the ground in the 18th century. Another example was Fuller mentions in his youth that his pastor was influenced by a pastor named John Johnson. And Johnson is largely forgotten today, but in his day, he was really the leader of an entire movement that was called the Johnsonian Baptist. He was extremely influential for a certain group of churches. And I found that you can only find some of Johnson's writings online. Only a few have been digitized. You can find them in the British Library, 18th century collections online, but they're by and large locked away in a city council city council library and archives in Liverpool. And I actually had to contact the library in Liverpool and have them digitized for me for my research. And until that point, no one had really had access to some of Johnson's material so that we could understand what Fuller was being exposed to as he's a young man growing up and hearing this kind of hyper-Calvinist message preached. One more example would be, I mentioned Matthias Maurice had the original pamphlet called Modern Question Modestly Answered, which launched the modern question debate. He had a subsequent publication in 1739 called The Modern Question Affirmed and Proved. I haven't checked, this year, but I have never seen it digitized or placed in a digital repository. And to find it, I had to go down to London to what was then the Dr. Williams Library, and they let me have one of the only few copies. And then I just typed it out word for word and used that in the dissertation research. And so I do think we've not had access to some of these materials as much as we would like. And I think we've also not attended to some of these eccentric people. And because of that, we've not considered hyper-Calvinism, at least in its 18th century variety. And as you said, there are consequences. I don't think sometimes we understand some of the things that Fuller is doing in Gospel Worthy because we don't understand these people with whom he's interacting. I think that's why I was confused as a PhD student. And if some of these pieces come into play, and I try to at least show this as best I can in the last chapter of the book, Gospel Worthy actually is doing a lot more stuff than we may originally or at first think. I think also, if we just have kind of a shallow narrative, hyper-Calvinism, then Fuller, we miss just how sophisticated this transition from hyper-Calvinism to Fullerism really was in Baptist and evangelical life. So just fleshing that out is helpful, just for broader historical concerns.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm getting sort of almost a little bit of an insight into what it means to do good historical work here and why problems do occur when we don't engage the primary sources and don't engage the primary sources of whoever they're interacting with. We come with our own modern presuppositions and conjectures, and that can cause issues, right? So you didn't mention John Brine or Lewis Wayman yet. Tell me a little bit about them and how they potentially are in agreements or disagreements with the others, like you've mentioned John Johnson and some of these others.
Yeah, that's a great question. So when we talked about eccentric characters, we are now definitely getting into the weeds of eccentric characters. So you and I are having fun here. This is a Baptist power hour for Baptist history nerds. So we can just be together on this, brother. But after Matthias releases his Modern Question pamphlet and the debate begins over the modern question, you do have these people taking either the hyper-Calvinist or the contra-hyper-Calvinist sides. And the first person to respond to Matthias Maurice in his pamphlet, in which he calls for open gospel preaching, is Lewis Wayman. And Lewis Wayman is very interesting. He grew up in Northamptonshire. So again, this is all located, or at least primarily located in this area. And he is imbibing many of the beliefs of Joseph Hussey in terms of eternal justification. But he has to make a decision. He really wants to give a rhetorically compelling answer to Matthias Maurice. And Matthias's pamphlet doesn't deal with justification. It doesn't get into sophisticated concepts that are found in Tobias Crisp theology. Matthias's pamphlet is just simple and straightforward. Is there a duty prescribed in the Bible that tells us that all people have an obligation to believe in Jesus? If so, then that must be held. And so Wayman tries to answer this conversation about duty and obligation before God. So he steps away from any conversation about eternal justification or Tobias Crisp or Joseph Hussey, and for rhetorical effect, just focuses on this idea of duty before God. And that's when he really starts to focus on this concept of Adamic inability, because in his mind, Adam could not believe the gospel. Today, there is no duty to believe the gospel. Adam's descendants are made as Adam was, and there's some intellectual or spiritual incapacity to believe the gospel. And so salvation is only from this unilateral work of God through the Holy Spirit, in which God really does not set the will free to believe the gospel, but override the will, where the person's almost like an automaton or robot, and they just are compelled to believe the gospel. And that way, human passivity is preserved. And I'm highlighting this fact only to say that while hyper-Calvinism in Northamptonshire started with conversations about Tobias Crisp and eternal justification, because of the influence of Matthias Maurice and the modern question, polemically, hyper-Calvinists shifted the conversation now to this concept of duty and obligation. They wanted to have this simple, rhetorically compelling response. So Wayman sets the stage for us here, and then it continues. You have other people involved. Abraham Taylor argues against the hyper-Calvinist position. He was famous for a time leading an academy for dissenters. And then John Bryan becomes involved. Bryan was actually brought into faith, it seems, under Gill's ministry, John Gill's ministry. Gill was close to Bryan. Gill preached the funeral service for Bryan's first wife and spoke at Bryan's funeral. Bryan was adamant that he held to eternal justification and that he held to Gill's theology in the sense of this understanding of a pactum salutis, minimizing human agency and human response to the gospel. But again, because he's following Wyman, Lewis Wyman, and responding to the modern question, he lays all of that aside. And in a tract called Refutation of Arminian Principles, he focuses again on this idea of Adamic inability and human inability to believe the gospel. And John Johnson's the same way. John Johnson is in Liverpool. I mentioned earlier his archives and his collections are there in Liverpool, but he was deeply immersed in the writings of Crisp and the Northamptonshire debates. And so Johnson also held to eternal justification, but to defend his hyper-Calvinist position, focused again on human inability to believe the gospel, not eternal justification. So in the modern question era, what I'm saying is that hyper-Calvinism has this dramatic shift where its most famous proponents now focus solely on human inability. And even though they held to eternal justification, they don't promote that concept in their polemical writings. So it's this idea of we need to be passive in salvation, has to be a unilateral work of God. And that sense, they're still faithful to their Tobias Crisp or Northamptonshire heritage. But now this human passivity is in a new key. It's based on human inability. God unilaterally overrides your will, and you're just there in Christ. And that is why universal gospel offers are not valid in their mind. Because when you offer the gospel to someone and tell them to respond, you're implying that they must indeed respond, that they have some sort of agency under the Spirit. And these people are saying, well, no, if this is an entirely a work of God, then you can't have an offer and call to response. You just preach the indicative of the gospel and trust that God will solely compel them and give them the supernatural ability to believe.
I've got like 15 questions.
That's great. Yeah.
So we've mentioned like the conversation shifts away from things like eternal justification, et cetera. Are they all still affirming eternal justification even when they make that shift? And do you think that that does play a role in defending or at least supporting the structure of the hyper-Calvinist logic?
Yeah, great question. They do consistently hold to eternal justification. They espouse it in their other writings, primarily, in which they're not just advancing their arguments for hyper-Calvinism. So in Brine's other writings or in Johnson's other writings, it's very clear. They're very adamant about their convictions regarding eternal justification. But it is just this, it seems, deliberate rhetorical choice when we defend hyper-Calvinism, because the stage has been set by Matthias Maries in terms of human obligation. And Wayman met Matthias Maries on those terms. Now we're following suit, and we focus only on human duty, human ability, human obligation.
You know, I think I don't know who they are, but the people have pointed out in the past sort of this correlation between the hyper-Calvinists who are focusing on this like duty obligation thing, where if you don't have the ability, then you don't have an obligation. And that seems to track pretty well with the flip side. If you were to go become an Arminian, to say, because you have the ability, you have the obligation. Does anybody recognize the sort of parallels in that period at any point and press that?
That's a fantastic point. Yeah, that is a great point. And someone does. There's a pastor named Alvery Jackson who is wanting open gospel offers and open calls for preaching, and in the sense of calling people to faith. And he finds in Arminius's writings where Arminius himself actually says that Adam did not have an ability to believe the gospel before the fall. And Arminius obviously never takes it to an extreme where he says, so people today do not have an obligation or ability to believe the gospel. But that is in Arminius's writings. And I tracked it down and found it. I quoted it in the book where Arminius is saying these things, and I contextualize his remarks so we can see why he says that. But Alvery Jackson digs this out, and he says very carefully, John Brine, when you attack the gospel preaching position, you call us all Arminians, and your publication is called Refutation of Arminian Principles. You're accusing us of not holding to sovereign grace, but you're the one who is actually espousing an Arminian position, because Arminius was the one who said people could not believe the gospel before the fall. Adam could not believe the gospel. So it's a great turn of phrase. And I'll just point out that if you look in Gospel Worthy, especially the first edition, Andrew Fuller read Alvery Jackson's pamphlet, and he says that exact message. He copies Alvery Jackson and says, makes the exact same point. And so Fuller accuses this of being more in the line of Arminianism than classical Calvinism. Yeah.
So which version does he says it in the first version?
He emphasizes it more strongly in the first one, but it's still suggested in the second.
Interesting. Do you have any idea why that change?
Yeah, good question. So the first version is, so to speak, more raw, I think. It's fresher in his experience coming out of a hyper-Calvinist background. And so there is a lot more there where he's interacting with Lewis Wayman, John Brine. He will name them by names. And when he doesn't name them by name, he will quote someone. And if you trace the quote back, you can see it's Wayman or Brine. And so I think in the second edition, it becomes a little bit more refined. It's less raw. Some of the characters are stripped out in terms of their identity, and just the strict arguments remain.
Okay, that's helpful. Now, here's a question for you. So I've read some of John Brine unrelated to these sort of topics, stuff on like just general Christology and other areas, and I found him really helpful. How do we go about engaging sources where they have what seems to be major errors, and yet they're very good and consistent in other areas? I mean, naturally, the question always ends up coming up for anybody who is an American theologian prior to the Civil War of, well, they're all racists and slave owners. Like, how do we engage somebody like that? So now here we have another major theological issue, and yet they have other good stuff. Like, how do we approach that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've struggled with it myself, because when I was reading through Brine's corpus, there were many points where, like you said, okay, this is very interesting, or this is actually very pastoral. You know, some of his sermons are very pastoral and spiritual. I've struggled with it, to be candid, with John Gill as well. The previous podcast I did with you guys, I was very much commending Gill in terms of his Catholicity, his reading of the patristic sources, his sophistication in terms of his Trinitarianism. And I stand by those remarks. I love all of those things about Gill. Since we've even met, I've published more about Gill's Catholicity because I'm trying to uphold to Baptists this idea that we are in the tradition. We're not disconnected from the broader Church Catholic. And I think Gill is one of the, if not the best exemplars of that fact in his theology. So as much as I've commended Gill to people, I do think that Gill held to a dangerous form of eternal justification that led to hyper-Calvinism. So I've struggled with it with Brian. I've struggled with it with Gill. And ultimately, if this helps, I found some solace in Jonathan Edwards' scholarship. And what I mean is, depending on how you read Edwards, he's either a classical traditional reformed person or he's very creative and experimental. And I think there's truth on both sides of those positions. And there's a lot to love in Edwards. And there are other parts of Edwards where we can say, well, that was interesting or that's contextual or that's creative, but I don't have to follow it today. I feel that way with Gill. So I very much appreciate the Catholicity and the depth, but I also think he's a product of his day and age. And his hyper-Calvinism is a result of his Northamptonshire location when he was growing up, where he was exposed to the writings of Tobias Crisp and these other people in the Crisp orbit. That's what he was taught as a youth, so that's what he imbibed and carried on. So he's a product of his day. It doesn't excuse it, but I'm uncomfortable rejecting his project wholesale. So yeah.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. So now that when we think about Fuller's overall response to some of these contextual issues, what's the sort of like overall theological vision that he's proposing in contrast to what these others are arguing for?
Yeah, that's a great question. He comes to his conclusions against hyper-Calvinism or his rejection of hyper-Calvinism fairly slowly. He grows up in a church context where, as I said, the pastor's influenced by John Johnson. They're also influenced by people like Wayman, implicitly often. And there's even a debate in Fuller's childhood at the church where someone is involved in immorality. And then they say, well, I can't help it. I have this inability to before God. And the church actually has to figure out and parse what that means. But eventually, Fuller found that context very stifling to his spirituality. And he slowly began to reject it. And there's a process that he goes through. And a lot of people have chronicled this. Peter Mornin has done a fantastic job. Our friend Michael Haken has done a fantastic job. I kind of lay it out in my book as well, building on their great work. So Fuller begins to reject hyper-Calvinism, and he begins to construct this alternative theological vision. And his vision very much is that while salvation is indeed solely a work of God, and while he maintains his commitment to Calvinism, that there is unconditional election and God's grace is effectual, we still, within this Calvinistic matrix, have a sense of human agency and human responsibility, and that God's sovereignty and a human response to the gospel are not at odds with one another logically, so that we cannot preach both truths. And so Fuller develops over time this, I think, rather sophisticated account of how human affections and human will are wooed by God so that human action matters, that faith is a response that God truly calls for, but at the same time, God is the one who receives credit through his grace for human faith. And you see this starting as he's writing Gospel Worthy. It develops much later in his life as he's debating the Sandemanians. And the Sandemanians called for what they said was a bare faith, just an intellectual assent to the gospel. And Fuller says later in his life, well, that sort of human passivity is very much akin to the hyper-Calvinism that I grew up in. And so the Sandemanian controversy causes him to even more... with more rigor, detail how human response to the gospel operates and works. So it's this kind of lifetime project that he has.
So I've got a more theologically contextual question that I'm going to ask in a second, but this just, the amount of controversy we've talked about has made me think about just like practical application for us today. I mean, in the past, clearly these thinkers, these pastors, these theologians are engaging in a lot of controversies that we would say are necessary and that required a response. Now today, those number of controversies have grown exponentially, but which has also, I think, at some level made everybody want to be like, I want to engage everything and be really loud, but also has done, had the reverse effect of saying, people saying, I'm going to avoid all controversies completely. So how do you think, given how Fuller interacts and how others in the past have acted, what sort of advice would they give us today to say, this is how you should engage? Because it seems Fuller says you have to engage some of these. So how do we understand when and how to engage in sort of polemical contexts?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're right. Fuller felt he was compelled to engage because he truly believed the openness of the gospel was at stake. He really desired to have free, open gospel preaching so that the churches could have spiritual life and vitality. And honestly, we know from history, had he not done that, the particular Baptists would have been in very difficult shape, at least more than likely. He was one of the key catalysts that helped turn around the particular Baptist denomination. There were other pockets of life, such as in the Bristol Academy scene, but Fuller was certainly a bright light to help reinvigorate Baptist life. So I think today what's sad is everyone tends to use the rhetoric of, this is a gospel issue. But we have to parse this carefully. Is everything truly a gospel issue? Fuller was involved in something that was a gospel issue, because it was dealing with how people are saved and whether we're actually preaching the gospel to people. But other things today may not be as directly tied to what we would think would be a gospel issue. Perhaps they're just our own biases or proclivities or our own cultural context that's shaping us. For what it's worth, in just my personal life, the best thing that ever happened to me was to put myself in different theological context. And so I'm from the South. But when I left the South and went to Europe, I saw different expressions of Christianity that were still Christianity, that still had the gospel, but just had a different cultural embeddedness or a different enculturation. And that helped me start to see, this is my culture from the South speaking, and this is a universal gospel principle that should be true of all God's people, whether they're in Europe or the South. And certainly living in California, I've had to wrestle with that even more. Significantly, because Los Angeles is interesting. Let's put it that way. So I think just getting out of our comfort zones and reading people that we know we disagree with, going to places where that may not be our own tradition, but we know there are people there of good will and have sincerity of heart, and talking to them and just trying to expose ourselves to broader conversations. We can still be convictional about our beliefs, but those exposures that we have tend to kind of knock down the unnecessary rough edges. It's sort of like the Mark Twain quote that the best anecdote to a closed mind is travel. So I think there's truth to that. Just theological travel through reading, intellectual development, and just interacting with different people.
I like that. And it reminds me of, what was it? It was, I don't know how long ago it was the practice, but it seems like for a long time, at least in the medieval and Reformation era, there was the practice of education meant you would wander around and travel to different places. That probably has a good positive impact. Now, one last Fuller question I want to ask you. You mentioned how he's developing sort of a sophisticated account of how the intellect and the will and all these different things are working together. How much of that is original to Fuller versus repackaging of Jonathan Edwards and others?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so Fuller has long been known as someone who is an Edwardsian. Edwards plays a key role in Fuller's transition away from hyper-Calvinism. Fuller makes use of Edwardsian categories called moral inability and natural inability to explain how obligation before God can work. What I found in my research is while those are indeed Edwardsian categories, they actually do predate Edwards in some ways. They're found in the writings of John Gill. And Michael Haken, interestingly, found a pamphlet or a tract that Fuller wrote, really more for his own personal reflection, right before he published Gospel Worthy. So it's sort of like Gospel Worthy in embryonic form. And what's interesting there is in that tract, it's not Edwards that Fuller is interacting with, it's Gill. And so it seems like Fuller is starting to see this in Gill, moral and natural inability. He interacts first with Gill in terms of these categories, and then Edwards helps push him along even further. And so I think those categories have a Gillian, but also Edwardsian provenance.
Yeah, if one thing I want to do when I travel back in time is find out why Gill and Edwards aren't corresponding.
Yeah, that's right. That you're exactly, yeah, because Edwards quotes Gill, as you know, in his publications. So
part of me just wonders, is it like, is that part of just Gill's personality where, like, I, you know, in my mind, like, I know a lot of people who are smart who don't want to interact with other smart people because, well, you know, just what happens when you've kind of like get this sort of emotional attachment to your status and you don't want to do anything. And I'm like, I always wonder if that's playing into that to some degree.
Yeah, yeah, I couldn't say for Gill. I mean, he's obviously aware of the conversations about the evangelical revival. So it is interesting that Edwards is the one who cites him.
Yeah. So, David, remind me, best place to go if people want to keep up with your work and to find all the rest of your publications, is that the Gateway website?
Sure, yeah, Gateway website is the best place to go. We have faculty profiles on our separate PhD website where we talk in more detail about our writings and even our upcoming writing projects. So you can click on the Gateway PhD website to see a full length of what's happening, not just with me, but with my colleagues as well. We've got several people here interested in the interface between systematic theology and kind of historical theology and history of ideas, and especially people interested in kind of 18th century evangelical type conversations. And it's a fun place to be because they all blend together.
Yeah, no, that's very exciting. You know, you mentioned you're over the PhD in THM. Do you also accept THM students? Like, I don't remember exactly. The THM I did had a thesis. So I'm assuming that there's a thesis component and that you would potentially be a supervisor.
Yes, no, thanks. So I accept PhD and THM students. And so we've got a student, you know, Aaron Pendergrass. Yeah. I'll give a shout out to him. He's writing on John Gill here at Gateway, doing great work. Except THM students, I'm supervising THM students primarily in the area of Christology because that's where I'm writing now. But Gill, evangelicalism, those are interesting topics to me as well.
Awesome. Excellent. Well, so now you guys know, if you're listening and you're interested in that area of study, to go check it out and find David and learn more about the program and see if that's a good fit for you. And I commend all of the work that David's doing. So he's awesome. He's got the exact blend that we like to commend here, where there's both the sort of rigor and academic expectations and standards, but also the pastoral heart and vision behind it, where we care about personal piety, care about the life of the local church, care about normal people, and don't want to just live only in the ivory tower. Despite the fact that there was a time when I thought about creating a YouTube show calling it the Ivory Tower just because it would be fun to do that.
That's awesome.
'Cause there is value in being in the Ivory Tower, but you have to think outside of it too and think about how the ideas, you know, flow out and encourage and serve other people. Say all that to say, go check out David's stuff and Gateway and everything. So everybody's been listening. Thanks for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you all soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.